Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia? Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found. We are back for another hour, the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We have a great, great show for you with a great, great guest, Don Wurchafter, the legend in the world of hemp and marijuana. Don, are you with us?
I'm here. Hi, Harvey.
Hi, brother. Good to have you, Don. I have been friends a long, long time. I have always tremendously admired his work on hemp and marijuana. He has. I'm not going to even begin to give him a description because I wouldn't do him justice. But we do want to talk today about pot and hemp. There's a lot of buzz. There was a big story yesterday on Huffington Post about marijuana policy that the White House is contemplating what they're going to do and not do to enforce or not enforce, God willing, the federal law. The federal law, of course, says marijuana is illegal, and we now have 18 states plus the District of Columbia say it's good for medical use, and now we have two states, the first two states in the world, actually since the 1930s apparently, to absolutely legalize pot. And so Don, let's start with hemp. I know you're one of the great pioneers in the field of hemp legalization and the uses of hemp for industrial purposes. You had a company called The Hempery in Southern Ohio that sold many things, including a pair of pants that I wore for many years made of hemp. I tried to smoke that pair of pants, by the way, and didn't work too well. But tell us, please, where do we stand worldwide with hemp? And tell us, Don, a little bit about yourself, please.
Thanks, Harvey. I started the Ohio Hempery in 1990 in my rural law office. I saw it as a solution to the criminal justice problems and the environmental problems that I was facing there in the law office. It was frustrating times with Reagan coming into power and the minimum mandatory sentences and the taking away the judge's discretion to sentence. I felt like I had to come up with an alternative.
Well, Don, let me jump in. You said you started in 1990. I think you meant to say 1980. Is that right?
No, I think that's really 1990 is the correct date.
Okay.
You said
something about Reagan coming into power. So.
Yeah, well, it's true. It was all those frustrations.
Go ahead. Sorry to interrupt. Please.
And, I put out a catalog, got the number 1-800 buy hemp and put out a catalog of hemp items. And I raised some money and was able to start funding small companies to produce hemp items for the catalog. We put out the first hemp paper and sold hemp twine. We put out the first hemp oils and sold it in the natural foods industry, hemp cosmetics. We got into making hemp fashions, which of course was my downfall, and over again trying to produce fashions from Appalachia didn't work.
It was your downfall?
I think so, yeah. We spent a lot of money trying to create hemp fashions to go mainstream, and there were supply problems, there were issues of shortcutting. There was a point where we won the Cannabis Cup in 1995 for a hemp shirt that was uniquely styled. That was at the end of November. In January 5th, we were at the New York Boutique Show to sell our shirt, had the big Cannabis Cup, you know, to promote it. And seven different Chinese companies had exactly our shirt, selling it for about our cost of production. And it was things like that. We had a strategy of trying to be made in America, trying to hold on to what was left of American production capabilities, and all that didn't work. one by one, the factories we were working with were going out of business.
And of course, hemp is legal in China as opposed to here, so it would make sense that they'd be able to do it a lot cheaper.
Oh, sure. Well, hemp is legal in just about every industrial country beside here. And they were able to do it cheaper because they're using 75-year-old machinery and they're using lots of labor that we don't have. And so they're able to produce hemp in a new way that, you know, wasn't available in history, but in a way that isn't really transferable to here. So I've spent a lot of time in recent years trying to come up with hemp harvesting technology that will be applicable here in the United States so that we can become self-dependent for our fiber again.
Well, that's pretty depressing. We're talking with Don Wirtschafter, great pioneer of the hemp industry, founder of the Ohio Hempery. And we're at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. So, Don, your company was based in Athens, Ohio, correct?
That's right. We started off in my third floor law office, hauling 25 or 50-pound bags of hemp seed up the stairs. Our first real hit product was a hemp seed cookbook that Carol Miller and I wrote. And then we were selling this cookbook, but we felt we were doing a disservice to people to sell them the cookbook without the seeds, just like it was a disservice to sell them the seeds without the cookbook. So we bundled them together and sold tens of thousands of copies of this cookbook in the early 90s.
Great.
And pretty soon we were selling tons of hemp seed, and all around the country we became the largest consumer of hemp seed in America. And all these seeds were being brought in mostly from China, and they were sterilized before we could get to them. So I was stuck in the position of being the only entrepreneur in the market talking about how poor the quality of my product was, how much better the quality of the hemp seeds we were selling could be if we could sell them here in America, if we didn't have to sterilize them first. And that went along pretty well until 1998. We had had a big success. We were pressing hemp oil in Athens, Ohio, bringing the container after container of hemp seeds in for the hemp oil. And then the byproduct of that was the hemp seed cake, which for every pound of oil you make, you have 3 pounds of solids. So we had a big pile of solids that we started selling to the local farmers for 9 cents a pound. And they got to really enjoy it. One farmer said that his cows wouldn't come in the barn if he didn't have the hemp for them. But we were looking for a higher end use of the seed cake, the solids that are left over when you press oil. And I came up with a way of making beer with it, which we sold to Frederick Brewing Company, and it became Hempinale, which became this hugely popular product that Frederick Brewing was able to take around the country and get distributed in ways that small breweries were really having trouble getting distribution. And it was just doing an amazing land office business until one day the publicist for Frederick Brewing got a case of Hempinale on Air Force One. And Carter's up front talking about all the, diplomatic stuff. And in the back, the reporters are drinking their hemp and ale. And they wrote mocking stories about it, which embarrassed the White House. You know, president selling marijuana beer or serving marijuana beer on Air Force One stories. And within a couple of days, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms took away our labeling approval. We were no longer able to sell hemp and ale. And that ground us to a halt. This is at the same time that the DEA moved in and cut off our supply of seeds. They told the company that was cooking the seeds for us that they could no longer do this.
Was it an American company?
Things were looking
Don, was it the hemp seed company, was it based in the U.S. or was it from overseas?
It was a U.S. company. Their primary market was sterilizing seeds for the bird food industry. They not only had to sterilize the hemp, but the Niger seeds that were brought into the country were considered weed seeds. So they had to sterilize those, too. But the DEA came in and told them they couldn't do hemp anymore, cutting off our supply. But this was 1998, and just with the right timing, Canada opened itself up for production. We were able to move to Canada. Now, this was in the winter of 98-99 or 97-98. We knew they were going to open up hemp production, and so there were shows across Canada where hemp was introduced to the farmers and industries of Canada. And I was asked to be one of the lecturers, and so I met several hundred Canadians and ended up choosing a partner in Canada and moving the hemp oil press up there, and that company has become the largest producer of hemp products in the world.
What's the name of it?
I don't know their name because they're producing it for bulk products for things like Nature's Path cereal or Dr. Bronner's soaps.
Wow. And how big a company is it? Can you give us a rough dollar volume?
I think their sales last year were $7
million. $7
million? Yeah, but growing rapidly. You know, there were several years where this was cut down. The DEA in 2001 moved to cut off any industrial hemp product for human consumption from coming into the United States. I still had a basement full of this stuff, and instantly my inventory became a hazardous waste that needed special disposal. And, you know, so $150,000 became a liability. Enough marijuana by the DEA's interpretation that it would be enough to get me the death penalty.
Oh, my God.
Because they count the weight of the carrier, and so you're all the weight of the oil and everything turned out to be a few tons. And so that would be the equivalent of a few tons of marijuana, what a major smuggler would have. And so this hemp oil that nobody could get high on or use as a drug instantly became enough to really get me in trouble if we didn't fight. And so thankfully the hemp industry came together and fought. I really credit David Bronner, who's the grandson of Dr. Bronner and the leader of that company. And Dr. Bronner's put up the bulk of the financing needed to hire the right D.C. lawyers and take this thing to court. And we sued the DEA in the appeals court, and we're just about to get a victory there, and the DEA turned around and changed their rules, and we had to start all over again and sue them in the appeals court. So we have Hemp 1 decision and Hemp 2 decision, both of which were stern rebukes to the DEA and their actions, and saying that the DEA had no jurisdiction over the use of industrial hemp for food. And since that decision in 2003, things have been fairly clear sailing for the hemp industry, but it had a lot of catching up to do.
Don, is industrial hemp being legally grown in the United States now?
Nah, not at all, except there's an exception maybe for a group in Colorado who has planted some industrial hemp. Where they got the seeds is hard to say. And
how did they get permission?
The approval of Colorado, which has stopped regulating these things, but the federal government would take umbrage at this if they had the priority, if they considered it a priority. Which means if they get any publicity about what they're doing, the federal government will come in and rip up their crops.
All right, we won't talk about them. Okay, so the status of industrial hemp in the United States currently is that it's illegal to grow. Is that correct?
Yeah, we had a chance. In 1993, we were able to convince the Irrigated Desert Research Station, the FDA research farm in California, to grow industrial hemp for us. Since it was a federal project, they didn't need a federal permit, and on and on and on. We did fine until the Attorney General of California got wind of what we were doing, and Dan Lundgren came in the field with his agents and tore down our crops just before harvest.
He personally did that?
Yeah, he did.
I'm
very
jerk.
Glad that man has been voted out of office finally. He lost his election in California. The only other example is in 1999, well, at the turn of the century, right before 2000, a very strong Hawaii state representative was able to push through a bill in Hawaii and then use that as leverage to go to D.C. and get them to give the project the federal license. And so right a couple of days before the year 2000, December 28th or so, 1999, we were able to plant industrial hemp seeds in an experimental field in Hawaii. And that project lasted a couple of years before it lost its momentum. It had all kinds of problems because the DEA was preventing the project from importing seeds. The person in charge of the project, Dr. David West, traveled to Japan, used the contacts that he had to get great Japanese germplasm and from other places in the world, but the DEA would not let him bring these things into the country. See, we're stuck here. In World War II, all of a sudden, this country woke up and realized that it needed industrial hemp. And this was a huge military priority. It took the resources of the War Resources Board, and they built 42 hemp factories, and they were able to get hemp growing by enlisting Boy Scout troops and all the patriotic things they could with posters and movies to get American farmers to grow hemp for the war effort. They were able to do this because one Kentucky farmer had grown a large crop of industrial hemp in 1941, anticipating the war needs. But here we are in 2013, where we are facing a similar fiber shortage that they faced at the beginning of World War One. But we don't have a hemp seed in the country. The hemp seeds that were donated to the U.S. Germplasm Bank in Colorado were not replicated. They weren't put into the inventory, and therefore they haven't been reproduced. And so the seeds are sitting there 50 years old and dead. And there's nobody allowed to have industrial hemp seeds in this country. And we are stuck now, with our pants down, because even if we wanted to get into a massive program to grow industrial hemp for the war or for housing, for food, for all the other things that we could use it for, we don't have seed one to get started.
And that's really insane. As I said, I had a guest on the show a few weeks ago, who estimated the dollar volume value of the Canadian hemp industrial hemp crop at about $500 million. Does that sound about right to you, Don?
Well, I think if you take it all the way through to the end product, that yes, that's certainly true. If you count that, the value of all the hemp granola and hemp waffles and hemp oil and hemp building products that are being sold, you might justify that figure just from the Canadian crop. And that's only to 30 to 50,000 acres at this point. It's still, a niche market. But Canada right now has been able to take the existing farm machinery and plant hemp and harvest it for its seed. What is going on now is industries across Canada are starting to recognize hemp for its fiber. Not just all the stalks left in the field when they're growing seeds, but soon they're going to be growing hemp in Canada just for the fiber, because it produces a higher quality fiber than if you let the stalks go on to produce seeds and harvest seeds.
Well, fiber to use in what?
Well, initially, the killer app for hemp right now is going to be building materials. We have a major shortage of building materials, fiber for making wood and all. And that's the first application of hemp. People are making hempcrete houses now. It turns out that the hemp herd, that's the inner part of the stalk, the woody part of the stalk, considered less valuable than the bark of the stalk with its long and lustrous fibers. But the herd is like little chips of wood. But there's differences. It combines extremely well with concrete. And if you make a wall with hemp and concrete, it actually hardens the hemp into stone. And it petrifies the hemp. And becomes the material good for thousands of years. It's light, it's very insulated. So this is what people are looking for in building materials right now. And in Europe, where there is hemp available, you're starting to see some major architectural buildings being built with industrial hemp. The first one that everybody points to as an example was a brewery warehouse that they were able to build with industrial hemp for less money than any other method, and it was far more insulated than anything else they considered. So that this huge warehouse where they have to keep the beer at exactly the right temperature is able to operate without temperature controls. They don't have a heating system or air conditioning system. The building is so super insulated that it takes care of itself.
That's amazing. We're talking with Don Wurchafter, clearly the leading, if not the leading, authority on industrial hemp, founder of the Ohio Hempery, one of the very first major businesses built around the use of hemp, industrial hemp, in this country. Don, and please call us if you're inclined, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Tell our wonderful producer, Matt, what your name is, and he'll email me, and we'll put you up on the radio here. Don, what's it going to take to legalize industrial hemp? Well, first tell me, and this has always been a mystery to me, what possible rationalization is there for making industrial hemp illegal? I've never heard anyone saying, give me a reason why industrial hemp should be illegal.
Well, I have to agree with you. And over time, the coalition of forces that was fighting the reintroduction of industrial hemp has disappeared. And there's really nobody fighting it. And there's now not even public opinion fighting it now. If you do public opinion poll in the United States, you're going to see that 79 or 80% of the people understand what industrial hemp is, understand it's distinct from marijuana, cannabis, or anything to do with drugs, and have no objection to our farmers being able to prosper on it.
If industrial hemp were legalized in the United States, give us, please, the basic uses and what you might estimate as the likely range of dollar volume of the business that will be done with industrial hemp in this country. We ascertained there's about $500 million a year in Canada now being done. What do you think would happen in the United States, and how would the money be made?
Well, we have some work to do before we're able to really prosper on this crop in the United States. I mentioned the seed problem, but it's not just not having the seeds. The seeds have to be the right seed. The hemp is extremely sensitive to the latitude in which it's grown, that it flowers based not on how long it's been in the ground, but on the length of nightfall, so that in the right time of the fall, the flowers start. And so the timing with the plants has to be right. And we don't really have varieties that are going to work here in the United States, and it's going to take some time to breed them. All of the industrial hemp being grown commercially, with the exception of Thailand. Oh, let me do something about these dogs. I think they'll stop in a minute. I hope that's not coming through on the radio very much.
That's all right.
I'm going to close the door at least.
Well, go get him stoned. Then he won't bark so much. We're talking with Don Wurchafter, pioneer of the industrial hemp industry in the United States. Our second half hour, we're going to be talking with him about actual marijuana. But as those of you listening can understand,
too many puppies, sorry.
Industrial hemp itself is a huge deal. Okay, Don, you got the dog situation under control?
I think so, yes.
Let's hear more about industrial hemp and its possibilities in the United States.
It's coming. You know, our farmers are prepped for it. They have the right equipment. You know, the soil and the climate is right if we can get the right seeds. What is this going to be used for? Again, primarily the first thing that we could use, you know, thousands of acres of industrial hemp on right away is building materials. Not just the hempcrete that I talked about previously, but people have engineered ways of making particle board-like panels or even structural panels, structural elements out of the building material. It's going to be used as insulation. The hemp fiber itself makes extremely good insulation that is long-lasting. It is as durable as the fiberglass, but doesn't have the environmental problems of the fiberglass, and it doesn't have the work to safety issues of fiberglass.
So, but for insulation, You would not use the leaves then. You take the stalks and shred them up, and that's how hemp is used for insulation?
Yeah. What I've spent a lot of time studying, especially in recent months again, is what's called a decorticator. That is the tool that you feed hemp stalks into, and out come the various constituents. You need to separate out the long fiber from the short fiber from the woody center called the herd. And, you know, decorticators were invented in the 1800s, and then they got kind of secreted away. Everybody started inventing decorticators, but they wouldn't show them to anybody. And I wrote a book called The Schlichten Papers about an inventor in the 1917 to 1927 era who invented a decorticator that worked really well for, and was able to take hemp from a stalk into fine fiber in one pass. He was working out in the desert of California where he didn't have moisture problems, and his method didn't work so well where it wasn't so dry, but he didn't have a chance. His plant burnt down, and it kind of killed him when his plant burnt down. And then in World War II, the United States revived the decorticator. We had 42 plants running throughout the Midwest where farmers were growing hemp, and it was being brought to these factories, and we were making parachute cord, and a lot of Navy ropes and things like that from the hemp during the war. We have to come up with new decorticators if we're going to make hemp work in the modern era.
Why is that?
Well, like for instance, in Europe and historically, hemp has always been retted to get it ready for processing. In other words, they would cut the stalks and leave the stalks laying in the field, turning them over once or twice over a period of 3 or 4 or 5 weeks. Until the inside of the stalk had gotten degraded enough, rotten enough, redded enough that the outside fiber, which is much more immune to bacterial colonization, the outside fiber would be loose and could be removed from the inside stalk. And this is how our ancestors were able to process hemp. It's only in the modern era that we're able to use machinery and process hemp without the redding. Now, Schlichten, that I just talked about, working out in California, was able to take these stalks and able to break them and into its constituent parts without having to do the redding process. The redding is a problem for many different reasons. One, it's hard to control. You're very dependent on the weather. You have to have exactly the right weather or you lose the crop. If it's too wet to go in there and pick up stuff off the ground, it rots over the course of the winter, and by spring it's too late to use it. Redding is also very extremely labor intensive, and we don't have labor in America. People aren't going to want to go do old time farm labor, you know, for minimum wage very much anymore. And so we have to come up with modern industrial methods, and people are starting to do this. I have a friend in Australia, and I wish this was a television show. I could show you some videos of his work. But he's invented a method of harvesting the plants green and taking the fiber apart immediately before it even has a chance to dry. What he discovered is that if you take a hemp stalk and you start to peel off the bark, it works really well. You can peel the bark right off. But if you let that stalk sit there for a half hour after you've cut it, the juices in the plant immediately begin to dry. As soon as you cut the plant, within a half hour, you can't pull the plant apart like you could when it was fresh and green. And if you let the plant dry all the way, then these juices that were the juices in the plant, they turn into glue, and they glue everything together. And so much of hemp processing in the past has been trying to take these glued together bundles of fiber and come up with methods of bleaching them or using enzymes or whatever to get all the lignans that are holding all these fibers together apart so that you can have the constituent fiber. But what they're doing in Australia, my friend Adrian Francis Clark has invented a decorticator that works with the green stalks. And it's pretty interesting watching the videos because you could take the green stalks and separate off the bark, and then put it in water, just kind of rinsing it with water a few times, you rinse off all these juices, all the green juice comes off the plant, and what's left is this bright white fiber. And that's what we're after. The fiber is much finer when you do it this way than if you let the fiber all dry and get all glued together. You can never get it back to its individual fiber.
And so this hemp fiber is used in what? What products do we get from this hemp fiber?
Well, this is going to be the high-end fiber that I'm talking about now. There's all kinds of low-end things that you can do for, like, building materials. But now we're talking about using the hemp for its best use, which is the fine, beautiful fiber that it has that is extremely excellent fiber for humans to wear because it is more comfortable than cotton. It was always the choice of African explorers or explorers of the past to have their linen suits because it would be much more comfortable in the hot weather or comfortable in the cold weather than cotton. And so clothing for our uses is one use. The other use where hemp is going to excel and really find its niche is in industrial fibers. Oh, for instance, airplane seating is, a big deal, because the airplane seat weighs like 75 pounds, but every pound you can save from an airplane is a pound of kerosene every time that airplane takes off, and these airplanes are taking off four or five times a day. So there's a huge amount of research going into making the interior parts of airplanes lighter. And these hemp fibers are going to be ideal for that. They're actually going to be able to make products that like carbon fibers out of hemp fibers. They have ways of taking hemp and baking it in the right oven to the point where it turns to carbon, and those fibers are the equivalent of carbon fibers in strength.
Wow, and fantastic. We're talking with Don Wertschafter. He is a great pioneer in the industrial hemp industry. We're going to take a break here, Don. Listen to Dana Lyons sing the Solartopia song for a minute or two. And then when we come back, we're going to talk about marijuana, the evil weed, as we say. Don Wertschafter, thanks so much for being with us, and we'll be back with you in just a minute.
Oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams.
Yes, indeed. Solartopia. We are back with it's the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show. I'm Harvey Wasserman. We're at 888-874-4888 if you want to call in, 888-874-4888. Talking with the great Don Wertschafter, a great pioneer in the field of industrial hemp. And Don, again, I'm going to ask you to go out on a limb real quickly before we switch to marijuana. What would you – can you give us even a ballpark guess of how – big an industry industrial hemp could be in the United States in dollar terms?
Well, I don't know. We're not talking a timeline or anything. It could get huge. It could, approach corn and soybeans as an industry.
Well,
it could.
I guess we're talking about many billions of dollars then, aren't we?
Yeah. There's no reason why it can't. It has so many uses. And There's such a need for more fiber and better sources of oil.
Good.
We haven't even talked about the nutritional properties of the plant.
All right, let's do that. Let's talk about them. Tell us about the nutritional properties. We can talk about marijuana as we go along, but what are the nutritional properties of hemp? I know I buy hemp milk at my local Kroger. I can't get it at the co-op, weirdly enough, or at Trader Joe's, but I can get hemp milk at Kroger's.
Right on.
So tell us, what are the nutritional value of hemp?
It's a veritable vitamin pill in hemp seeds. You have extremely high quality, what are called essential fatty acids. These used to be vitamin F before they realized they couldn't put them in a vitamin pill, so they came up with the name essential fatty acids. But you need more of this vitamin than all the other vitamins combined. And this is your linoleic and linolenic oils that you get from seeds, you know, some seeds. People eat flax oil for its linolenic oil content. And hemp is an excellent, excellent source of these oils that we need, that doctors are going to use to treat a variety of diseases. Things like eczema, psoriasis, all kinds of diseases around dry skin, but people are also being recommended hemp seed oil after heart attacks, after strokes.
Why? What does hemp oil do for you after a heart attack or a stroke?
Well, first we're talking about these essential fatty acids that are the basic building blocks of the long chain fatty acids that become the they become basic enzymes in your system. They become the building blocks of brain chemistry, these long chemicals. They are part of your immune system too. And prostaglandins is the word I was trying to come up with. These are things you need. The essential fatty acids are the lubricant in your cardiovascular system. And we don't get enough of them. Scientists are recognizing the fact that our diet now has been engineered to not give us essential fatty acids, that in the quest to have foods with shelf life, they have hydrogenated out the good oils, or they have created foods without any oils in them, because good oils go rancid. The better an oil is for you, the quicker it's going to go rancid. And so these good oils have just been taken off our grocery store shelves at our expense.
Well, what about hemp oil? How quickly does hemp oil go rancid?
Oh, you have about a year if you keep it refrigerated.
You're
going to find it in the refrigerated shelf of your health food stores, next to the flax oil. And for people who have dryness around their nails or have trouble with dry skin, I really recommend them trying hemp oil, using it for several weeks. Give it a chance to actually change the makeup of the oils in your body. It takes a while for it to have an effect, but people really believe in it.
And so if you have a bad rash, would you rub hemp oil on it?
Oh, yes, definitely. And we make a salve.
Now, who is we?
Yeah, well, this is the last product that came out of the hempery. It was one of my first ones, the ones that they just wouldn't let me stop making. So Equinox Botanicals now makes the salve, and it's available through Equinox Distributing. And this is hemp oil with a lot of herbs. It costs us $4,000 or $5,000 every time we make a batch of the stuff just for the herbs in the formula. And it's just an amazing thing to use for healing from all kinds of conditions, surgery, cuts, rashes. It'll take out poison ivy in one application.
Well, very interesting. Let me just ask you a personal question. Is hemp oil superior to flax oil to be taken internally?
Well, listen, they're saying that most of us are deficient in these super omega oils. And flax has more of it than hemp. So what many physicians are recommending is that people start with flax oil and do a couple of bottles of flax oil just to get their balance back into line, and then use hemp oil from then on. So hemp oil is extremely balanced in favor of the omega-3s. And hemp oil has got the right balance between the omega-3s and 6s. So hemp oil, flax oil first, for some of these conditions, and then switch to hemp oil after a bottle or two.
Interesting. We're talking with Don Wirtschafter, the great pioneer in the industrial hemp industry, and, of course, the medicinal hemp industry. So you're saying this product, hemp oil, is available from Equinox Botanicals in southern Ohio?
Yeah, well, I'm saying that the hemp oil itself is available from several different manufacturers and is certainly available in your health food store, wherever you shop, pretty much. The, you know, the other product is the hemp nut. People developed machinery for taking the hemp seed apart. Now, the cookbook we wrote in 2002 told people how to do this at home in their blender, using their blenders to remove the hard shell from hemp seed. But now you can just go to the health food store and buy hemp nut. And it's excellent. It's very useful. You'll find 100 ways to use it right away as a garnish on top of foods.
This is legal. The hemp nut is legal.
The hemp nut is totally legal and available in a health food store. It costs about $3 a pound. And it's comparable or substitutable for almonds or any other nut. It works great on top of salads or pasta dishes.
Oh, so it's like a pine nut.
Fish with it. What's that?
Does it taste like a pine nut?
Yes, it very much is useful as a pine nut. It makes a great pesto.
Wonderful. All right, Don Wirtschafter giving us some recipes with hemp oil and hemp seed and now the hemp nut. I haven't seen a hemp nut in the stores, but I'm going to have to start looking for it, and then maybe I'll request it. All right, Don, let's get down to the nitty-gritty here. 18 states, I believe, or 19, have legalized medical marijuana. Two have legalized recreational marijuana. The feds are trying to decide what to do. There were more marijuana arrests in the United States last year and pretty much every year for the last 20 years or so, or 40, actually, since the start of the drug war with Richard Nixon. What's going to happen with legalization of pot and the Obama administration, and what do we need to do about it?
Well, this is interesting and very topical right now. I just attended a conference this weekend in California put on by California Normal, commemorating the 100 years of drug prohibition in California. And this was certainly the topic on everybody's mind. What are the feds going to do? And it looks like they're not going to do very much at all. We're already 3 or 4 weeks into this thing. You have legal pot clubs opening up every day in Denver and Seattle, and nothing's being done. And I really think that's what we're going to see from the administration is just, you know, a cautious stand back and see if the roof falls in. And this is really all we've been asking for the 40 years that I've been an activist in this area. We're just trying to come up with regulated systems of distribution of marijuana to see if the roof's going to fall in. And then when people realize that the roof hasn't fallen in, then maybe they'll consider some other innovative ideas to get us out of this worthless, wasted war on drugs.
Well, I just read a long piece, a very long piece, I think it was on Huffington, about the so-called Ogden Memo, which
yes,
a few years ago gave everybody the idea that the administration, federal administration, was going to lay off people in the states. And that turned out to not be true. Obama went in and did bust major players in the medical marijuana industry, including, tragically, Oaksterdam University. I'm wearing their shirt right now in downtown Oakland, the great Richard Lee. So how do we know we're not getting baited and switched here again?
Oh, I totally agree. I happen to be wearing my Oaksterdam sweatshirt right now. So be matching.
Well, we both made a fashion statement here on the radio.
I think it's been tragic. And I guess I have to agree with everybody that this was election year politics. They were trying to appear tough on drugs, and it surely didn't work. They did not gain one extra vote because they started cracking down on California dispensaries, and they certainly lost votes. I'm disappointed with the president and his handling of this particular issue, which is at times making me feel like a one-issue voter.
But, well, you're allowed. That's the American way.
Yeah. Well, compared to what we've had, I'm still a big fan. But he sure has not been good on this issue. But, you know, there's lots of speculation that he is going to get smart, that he has now the political capital to do some smart things, in at least at the beginning of his second term. So, I mean, there's many hipsters looking forward to the State of the Union speech coming up, and will he say something smart here? You know, there's the danger that if the Democrats flood this issue for another 3 years, the Republicans, who watch their polls far better than the Democrats, are going to see that this is a swing issue. This is a way of bringing the youth out to vote and all this stuff. And all of a sudden, you're going to have the Republicans, who have been just dead set against this issue all the way along, switching sides just for the political advantage. It's been a nightmare of mine for several elections now, but I really hope the Democrats wake up and see the scenario and do something about it, and just start studying the situation. Do something to change the status quo, because 65 years, 70 years of this prohibition has only made things far worse.
Right, and this is a president who, when asked if he inhaled, it was known. I mean, he talked about smoking in college, or even in high school, actually. And when asked if he inhaled, he said, well, that was the point. So what possible reason can they have for continuing to prosecute, persecute people who are doing medical marijuana? I just read a horror story about a family in Montana that opened a medical marijuana clinic, and they were doing fine, and they got busted, and the father who had medical problems died in federal custody. I mean, this is a nightmare.
Yeah, that's an especially tragic case, but there's tragic cases up and down the West Coast with people who took the president at his word and operated extremely carefully with the right accountants and lawyers and everybody to be in unambiguous compliance with state law, which was the standard that the Ogden memo set. And even though they were doing things right and being open about what they were doing and operating as a legitimate business and paying their taxes and paying their employees and, you know, keeping, you know, all of, you know, the neighborhood clean and straight and all these things, they're still harassed by the feds. And it seems to me like the feds were just going after the ones that looked really successful. There wasn't really, instead of going after the low fruit, going after the businesses, you know, who are more shaky, they've gone after Oaksterdam, they've gone after Harborside, they've gone after several hundred of these good dispensaries with landlord letters threatening the landlords if they didn't evict the dispensaries. The new
I think, Don, there was just a court case, a decision said they couldn't do that, but I may be wrong.
Well, that's right. That's what I was just about to say. The new news, what we were celebrating over the weekend, is Harborside's decision, where they went to court on their eviction. The landlord listened to the feds, got a lawyer, and tried to evict Harborside, who had paid their rent every month and had been a good tenant. And the landlord had to admit, yeah, they've been a good tenant. Yeah, they paid. Yeah, I knew they were opening a dispensary. Yeah, there haven't been any issues about safety, or none of the other tenants are complaining. None of those things. I'm just doing this because the feds are making me. And the judge said, no, you can't do that. We're not going to enforce federal law here. This is a state court, and they are in compliance with state law, and I'm not going to evict them. And so that was a big victory for Harborside, and hopefully we'll slow down this momentum where the U.S. attorneys are using their power of threat to close down these dispensaries without ever having to go to court for them.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's really ridiculous.
To go back a question, though, I think a lot of this problem is the fact that during the Bush administration, he hired a lot of really, really conservative U.S. attorneys and assistant U.S. attorneys, a lot of them out of the Regent Law School. And then these people were all given civil service. They're all still in the Justice Department. They're all still working there. And they're working for purposes contrary to the purposes of their boss, the president.
Well, let's hope that this lays off. So, Don Wertschafter, is there really evidence that marijuana has medical properties?
Huge evidence. Huge evidence. If you came into my house, I would show you my collection of antique cannabis medicines, because people were telling me, oh, no, cannabis has never been recognized as a medicine. I have been collecting for a few years evidence of how widespread the use of cannabis was in the pharmacies 100 years ago. But in the modern context, where the profession demands these replicable, blind, double-blind, you know, gold standard tests, cannabis still is scoring as a very valuable medicine. There are, if you want to research on the internet, hundreds of human studies that have shown the reliability and usefulness of cannabis when used as a medicine. Some of these studies are done in the United States, especially in California, where they funded some of these studies. Many of them are being done in Europe, where their scientists are not as handcuffed as our scientists here from studying the drugs. The federal government's caught in the position of saying, well, cannabis isn't a medicine, yet at the same time it has a patent on cannabis used as a medicine. It has several patients that it's continued to supply cannabis to on a monthly basis. And, you know, there are now 17 states, 18 states, I believe, that have recognized cannabis.
I think it's 18 plus the District of Columbia.
Yeah, and this has reached the mainstream. It is recognized as a medicine in the United States. Yet at the same time, the appeals court just said that the DEA has the discretion to remain, to keep cannabis in Schedule One, meaning it has no legitimate medical use in the United States, and possession of it becomes a major federal crime. And it's all artificial. It isn't based on science at all. It's based on repressing science. And the scientists can't get cannabis to study it in the United States.
That's insane. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, why don't they could just go down to the corner and buy some, for God's sakes.
Sure, but you'll never get that in a published journal.
Yeah, right. I went down to the corner for our research and asked somebody for a lid, and by God, the second person I talked to gave me some. I had an experience in California, actually. I have a medical marijuana card in California, and I went to two clinics, and they would not honor my card. They said that the people who had done it had been driven out of business. And then I picked up a hitchhiker and bought, like, you know, whatever I needed for, like, $2. It's like, hello. We're talking with Don Wirtschafter. Superb. Don, I pursued you for this show for, like, a month or two, and you've been a really great guest, just a wealth of knowledge. So where do we stand? What's going to happen next with medical marijuana and marijuana in general? I'm assuming, as most people are, I think, that the various states are going to watch the experience in Colorado and Washington state and see if they make money. And if the states make money on legalized pot, all these other states are going to legalize it, don't you think?
Yeah, well, California Board of Equalization, the board that does their sales taxes, reported $110 million collected from marijuana dispensaries last year.
How much?
$110 million.
Oh, my God.
You know, this is a state that's hurting for money, and $110 million is a significant amount of revenue for California, and it will get up to $1 billion if they get a real system in place. We lost that system by a vote last year by about 2% of the vote.
Well, we think that was actually rigged. You know, that's one of my other interests. There's a lot of evidence that the vote and the gay marriage vote were stolen.
Yeah, well, I absolutely admire the work you're doing in this area with Bob Fetrakis and others.
Well, hey Don, on that helpful note, I'd like to have you back. There are a couple more things I want to talk to you about next week, if you have time. Again, let me know by email. This has been the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show, talking with the great Don Wirtschafter. Don, do you have a website people can look for you?
I really don't. I would tell people to look at votehemp.org.
Votehemp.org. Okay. Don, come back with us next week if you can. It's been great talking with you about medical marijuana, about industrial hemp, and the whole nine yards of cannabis. And sometime or other, we'll have you back on the show. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening in. It's been another Green.
So we've been digging into the ground.